They did it again. They put the water way down here where I really have to disappear. First off, I want to say how great it's been to be at Mount Eagle and see some old friends and make a lot of new friends. It's been wonderful, and I'm afraid you got me hooked. I'll be back. I'm Lucille, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm going to introduce myself the way I was taught when I came into this program. By the grace of God and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't had a drink since April the 6th, 1952. That's purely a miracle. This has been the most wonderful thing that could have ever happened to me, is being a member of AA. It has been the most rewarding thing that ever happened to me, because it's given me something to live by and something to live for. And I am the most grateful person in the world. I don't even know how to start. I guess at the beginning. I think I was one of those born to be alcoholics, because when I took my first drink, I got drunk. I had gone to a party, a daytime party. I hadn't been married but a very short time. And I knew absolutely nothing about alcohol. We didn't have it in our home. I hadn't been around anybody that drank. I knew absolutely nothing about it. But my husband was an alcoholic. I didn't know it. Had no idea. And somebody dared me to take a drink. And I never was one to take a dare. So I took that drink, and I didn't have enough sense to know what they were doing to me. It was back in the days of old white corn whiskey. And they poured me a water glass almost full, and I drank it. I remember getting a little bit sick, an awful lot drunk. And I made my way to the nearest bed, and I passed out. But you know what happened? I slept a couple of hours, and I got up, and I went back and took another drink. So I don't think there was any doubt in the world that I was just ready for it. I cannot stand here and tell you I ever had any fun drinking, because I don't remember any fun. I know now that I drank to escape. I drank because I couldn't face life. As I said, I had married an alcoholic without realizing it. And for the next 12 years, I was a battered wife. I'm grateful today that I have been able to forgive him. He died in the city jail from being drunk. The only good thing that came out of that marriage was two wonderful children. Of course, a war sort of intervened, so there's 8 years difference in them. And he died when the youngest one was about 4 years old, almost five. So my youngest son never knew his father, because we were separated and divorced by then, because I couldn't take it anymore. But the youngest boy never knew him at all. The older boy knew him and loved him very much, because to him he was always kind. And for that I'm grateful. He died in March of 1952. And today I'm very grateful to him, because I think it took his death to make me realize what had happened to me. I did 98% of my drinking alone. As I said, I never had any fun drinking. I drank to escape. And fortunately, I was periodic, so I was able to earn a living and take care of my children. Sometimes not too well, but they always got fed, and they always had something on their backs. And after he died and I realized what had happened to me through his death, it made me realize where I was going. And on Saturday night I had been drinking, and I waked up about 2 o'clock in the morning and started walking. And I walked that house back and forth, back and forth. And I finally ended up in the bathroom to brush my hair and wash my face before I got the boys up. Well, the oldest boy wasn't at home. He was away at school. But I had to get the little one up. So I went in the bathroom to wash my face. And I looked in that mirror. And I saw myself. I had that famous moment of clarity that we hear about in AA. It was very, very evident. And I fell on my knees there in that bathroom, and I said probably the most sincere prayer I'd ever said in my life. And very simple. I just said, God, please show me the way out. And he did. The words Alcoholics Anonymous came into my mind, and I didn't know one thing about it. I had heard some other people talking about it, but I didn't know anything about it. But those words came into my mind, and I got up off my knees and went straight to the telephone and called. And I was sick. Oh, I was so sick. They didn't come fast enough to suit me, so I called them back. When I made up my mind, I was ready. And in a little bit, a man and a lady came to my house. And I'll never forget it as long as I live. When I opened the door, Sarah walked in and put her arms around me. And she said, honey, I understand. And nobody had ever understood before. Nobody could possibly understand what I was doing. But she did. And she had me hook, line, and sinker. She could have told me to stick my head in the fire and I would have tried it. She had me totally under her control with that one statement. And they stayed there and talked to me for quite a while. And I was desperately sick and shaking, oh Lord. I shook like an aspen tree in a hurricane. But Sarah stayed with me until, I guess, 7 or 8 o'clock that night. And even in that condition, I got up on Monday morning and went to work. I don't know why they didn't fire me that day, but they didn't. And I made my first meeting on Tuesday night. We only had three groups in Shreveport, Louisiana at that time. I'm a native Atlantan, but I had moved away and was gone for 33 years and lived in Shreveport. And that's where I went into AA. When I made that first meeting, I was still shaking, sick. Wanted to just crawl off in a hole somewhere. People were so kind to me. I don't remember a word that was said at the meeting, but the kindness got through. They let me know they cared. And that was the first time in many years that I had felt that people cared. I hope we'll always do that in AA. Let the newcomer know that we care, that we want to help. After that meeting was over, Sarah and a man in AA had come to get me that night and take me to that meeting. And after the meeting was over, they brought me home and they came in and stayed for a while. And they were talking AA a mile a minute, and it wasn't making one bit of sense to me. But I tried to listen. And this man had 6 years of sobriety. He'd come to AA in 1946. And they were talking away, and finally I looked at him and I said, "What am I going to do about this horrible compulsion to take a drink? I knew what a drink would make me do for me. It'd make me feel better." And he looked at me and he said, "Lucille, do you believe God can remove that?" And I said, "I don't know what I believe right now. But I want to stay sober." And he said, "Then ask God to remove the desire." And that became a part of my morning prayer. "Dear God, please take the desire to drink away." And it only took about 10 days. And the desire was gone, and thank God it has never come back. I have never faced a situation yet where I thought a drink would make it better. About, I don't want to exaggerate this, but I think it was about a week later that this man called and asked me to go out to dinner. And we started going together. And 18 months later, we announced at the group that we were going to be married. Oh boy. You never saw such head shaking and tongue clucking in your life. Two alcoholics, it'll never work. It's terrible. We just looked at them and grinned and went right ahead with our plans. And we were married in October 1953. I had 18 months of sobriety, and I look at it now and I think, ye gods. But it worked, and it worked beautifully. Watt was an old bachelor. He was 46 years old when we married. Didn't know a darn thing about kids. Didn't know how to stay at home either. But he loved those boys as much as if they were his own flesh and blood. And they loved him. So we started out, I started to say on the ordinary basis, but that's not true. It was a very extraordinary basis. We went to meetings regularly. The first 7 years I was in AA, I made 8 meetings a week. And I don't regret one single minute of it. I learned a lot because I wanted to. I wanted to understand. I wanted to understand the alcoholic. I wanted to understand myself. And we made a life. We had a home with a lot of warmth, a lot of love, and a hell of a lot of drunks. My favorite story. After Watt died, I was president of a board of a halfway house for women, and our director got drunk. And we were at odds ends knowing what to do. And finally I looked at him and I said, I'll tell you what, if you want me, I'll quit my job and I'll move in. And they were tickled to death. So I did, I moved in. And when I celebrated my 25th anniversary, my youngest son came over from Atlanta. Both the boys ended up in Atlanta, don't ask me how. And he came over to help me celebrate. And after the meeting, we were sitting at the kitchen table talking. And one of the girls who was a resident there had gone to school with him. And she looked at him and she said, Evan, what was it like growing up in a home like you grew up in? Because she'd heard me tell all these wild tales. He didn't crack a smile. He said, perfectly normal home. Lots of love. Lots of security. Perfectly normal home once you learn to step over drunks. And that's pretty much the way it was, because Watt and I both did a tremendous amount of 12-step work. Constantly. We had one stretched out somewhere most of the time. There were very few weeks that we didn't have a drunk in our home. Watt would get his big book and his butterfly net and go out and drag them in. And I drug in a few myself. But it was a wonderful thing to watch him sober up, to watch him have a little hope in their faces. We've had everything from streetwalkers to priests. I'll never forget one priest we had. Watt called me at the office and he said, honey, we have a guest. And I said, what's new? And he said, this is special. And I said, what is it? He said, it's a Catholic priest. And I said, oh boy. Because I'd gone to Catholic schools all my life. And when I got home, they were sitting in the living room talking. And I think that poor man was scared to death of me. And I just let Watt have him, and I went on to the kitchen and fixed dinner. And after dinner, he looked at me and he said, do you have an iron? I said, yeah. What you need? And he just had his shirt on, and he said, Watt was going to take him to somewhere, I don't know where. And he said, my vest and my collar's in a terrible shape. I said, go get it. So I put up the ironing board and got the iron ready. He brought it in, and he had spilt chili all down the front. It was all over his collar and all over his black vest. It was a mess. And he looked at me and he said, "Isn't that terrible?" I said, "It just looks like a good drunk to me." That broke the ice and we became very, very good friends. But those were the sort of things that went on in our house all the time. And it was fun. It was fun watching people get well. And I loved every minute of it. Because I never knew when I got off from work and went home how many people I had to feed. Because I would go out and gather them up and bring them home. But that was all right too. I was young back in those days. And it was a good life. It was a good life. I'll have to admit there were some times when I would get so tired that I'd think I wish they'd all go home or somewhere. And almost every meeting we went to, at least five or six came home with us. And we'd have ice cream, coffee, and they'd stay till midnight. I finally learned a lesson, though. When I got tired and sleepy, I'd just say, "Bye," and I'd go to bed. I'd have to. But it was fun. And I never will forget one night, Watt had several men there, and one brand new man, and I went on to bed. But we had a louver door between the living room and our bedroom. So I could hear what was going on. And they were telling this man how great it was to get sober, get his life straightened out, and said, "Get your wife back." And all of a sudden I heard this real pitiful voice say, "Fellas, do I have to?" He wasn't in favor of getting his wife back. But that was our life. And we had worlds of friends. We went to conventions all over the country, outside the country. And it was great. And I loved every minute of it. Our boys were growing up. The oldest boy went away to college, and the youngest one didn't give one hoot and heck about school until he got to high school. And when he got to high school, he buckled down and went to work and really made wonderful grades, and they both graduated as valedictorians of their classes. And of course, you can just see the pride on their mama's face. I was so proud of them, I didn't know what to do. I'm going to touch lightly on those boys to give you an idea of what's going on. The oldest boy graduated from the University of Southern California, got his master's degree. The youngest boy went to Texas A&M his first year. He thought that's what he wanted to do. He came home after the first year and won all sorts of honors. Came home after his first year and said, "I'm not going back." And I said, "What do you mean you're not going back?" He said, "I'm not going back. I'm going to stay right here at home and I'm going to Centenary." That was a college in Shreveport. And was only about three blocks down the street. We couldn't get rid of him. Not that we wanted to. So he stayed and graduated from Centenary and then went to Tulane and got his master's degree. Now, make a long story short, they've both been very successful. But they're still my boys. And they have been wonderful to me. 22 years ago this month. Well, I got a telephone call from a man in Tennessee, Pete Wassef. Some of you here may have remembered him. His story was in the original big book. We had been to Chattanooga for Watts' 25th birthday. They had a party for him up there. And Pete was not drinking, but he was in a very low spot. And he asked Watt if he'd come up and spend a few days with him, and I said, sure, he'll go. No doubt about it. And he was going to drive. And Watt wasn't feeling good at all, and I knew it. He had a real bad heart and had had several heart attacks. And I was worried about him driving up there. And Joe DeWitt from Chattanooga was a very close friend of ours. And Joe called, and I said, Joe, I'm worried. And he said, what's the matter? And I said, Watt's planning on driving up to Pete's, and I'm worried about him. He said, you tell him. I said, stay right there. I'll send the plane for him. So Joe sent the plane down and picked him up and brought him back to Chattanooga. And he spent the night with Joe, the first night he was there. And I didn't know it at the time, but Joe stayed up with him all that night because he wasn't doing well. But he never gave up. He just kept going, regardless of how he felt. And the next morning, he went over to Cleveland. And I think it was that night or the next night, he and Pete started to a meeting. And on the way, Watt had a heart attack. And Pete turned around and took him home. And just about the time they got back and he got Watt down on the bed, Joe called. And Pete went around to answer the phone. And he told Joe what had happened. And Joe said, you get him to the hospital. Well, Pete had tried, and Watt said, no, just take me down back to your house and let me lay down. I'll be all right. And Joe says, you get him to the hospital. Don't you fool around. And Pete walked back in the room to tell Watt that he was going to the hospital. And Watt was gone. And he had died while Pete was on the telephone. My sister was visiting me. And we had gone out to dinner. And I got home, I guess it was 9:30. And as we went in the driveway, she said, Lucille, there's somebody in your house. And I just laughed. I said, I hope it's somebody I know. Because Watt gave out keys to our house like most people give out visiting cards. And the ones who didn't have a key knew where one hung. And if they needed or wanted anything, they just went over and we were home fine. And if we weren't, they just went in and got what they wanted. We never thought anything about it. So I just laughed and just said, I hope it's somebody I know. And when I got out of the car, we had a cyclone fence around the backyard. And when I got to the gate, I saw my boss and our doctor. And I immediately knew something had happened to Watt. And what had happened was, Joe didn't call me. He called our doctor, who was a member of AA. And they started hunting for me. And they called everywhere they could think of that I might be, but of course they didn't know that I was out to dinner. And the word spread like wildfire. And by the time I got home, there were about 50 people in our house. They already had coffee made, a great big pot. Somebody had brought in. and they were ready for me. The outpouring of love from those people and many, many like them in the next few days was unbelievable. That's one of the rewards of AA. Joe went around and picked up people all over the place in his plane, and Jim was one of them, and brought them down for Watt's funeral. I had a guest book laying in the living room. Somebody had put there, I didn't. I couldn't do anything, I was in total shock. Shouldn't have been, but I was. And there were over 700 names in that book at home when I was able to look at it weeks later. And the one at the church, I don't know how many names were in there in the funeral home. But people were absolutely wonderful. Just, I couldn't have asked for immediate family to be as great as the members of Alcoholics Anonymous were. You see why I love it so? They literally carried me through that time. They picked me up and carried me. And for that, I will always be grateful. It was a wonderful experience being married to Watt Lindsay. Very few people have that kind of an experience. You would have had to know him to appreciate that remark, because he was some kind of a fella. Jim calls him the meanest man that ever lived, and he wasn't mean at all. He had the softest heart in the world for anybody. We had a wonderful life together. And when he was gone, I was lost. I didn't know what to do. But everybody gathered around and helped me. And that was wonderful. And I had been elected to be chairman for the month of June. He died on the 21st of May. And one of the members came over to the house and said, "Who do you want to take your place?" And I said, "Nobody." And he looked at me like I was crazy. And I looked at him and I said, "What would have expected me to do it?" So I did it. And I started picking up the pieces. And I started making a new life for me and for my youngest son. My oldest son was married by then. Well, as a matter of fact, so was the youngest one, come to think of it. But they, of course, had both come as quickly as we could find them. And they have been, well, there's no way for me to express how wonderful they've been to me. After Watt died and I went to that halfway house as director, most rewarding thing I've ever done in my life, I stayed there 4 years and loved every minute of it, and made some of the closest friends I've ever had. One of them was a gal from a little bitty town there in Louisiana. And Ella was almost 6 feet tall and strong as a mule. And in my mind, I could still do what I did when I was 20. And I'd get in the middle of these projects and just couldn't do them. And I'd stand wherever I was and I'd holler, "Hey, tall stuff." And wherever she was in the house, she'd yell back, "I'm coming, short stuff." And she'd come and get me out of my messes. And we became extremely close. Wonderful woman. And after I moved back to Atlanta, periodically she'd call me up and she'd say, "My tires are just dying to hit I-20. She had married after she left Oakwood. And I'd say, "Well, come on." So she'd drive over from Shreveport to Atlanta, stay a couple of days, and I'd go home with her and stay about a month. And then she'd bring me back. Now, you don't have many friends like that in this world. But she was a true, true friend. She died about 4 years ago. I had the opportunity to be with her on her last AA birthday. She had 14 years when she died. She was in the hospital, but I was there. And I still catch myself every once in a while walking to the telephone thinking, "I've got to call Ella." And then it dawns on me, Ella's not there to call anymore. But she was a dear, dear person. And she stayed sober and she did a tremendous amount of work. I've had the occasion to have friends like that all through the years. Wonderful friends. I've got a little gal now that I'm sponsoring by proxy. I didn't know I was a sponsor. She announced it one night. Who has been so kind to me and so loving. And when she found out I was coming up here, she said, "Give me a box, your mailbox key and your front door key. I'll go and get your mail and take it in for you." I said, "Okay." And I had a little episode with heart fibrillations a couple of weeks ago. And she was right there with me to the hospital and came up every day. She was wonderful. And she says, "I'll check on you." And we were laughing about it the other day. I said, "One of these days I'm going to die in my sleep and nobody's going to know me and I'm going to be stinking by the time y'all find me." She said, "Don't you believe it." I said, "Well, the answering machine will be on. You'll think everything's perfectly normal." She said, "If I don't see or hear from you in 2 days, I'll be there." That's the kind of friends you make in this program. There's no comparison anywhere because we know each other and we learn to love each other with a sincere love that lasts, like mine for Jim and Mickey. Over 35 years, and it's been great. Shortly after I moved back to Atlanta, I had a bad time one day. I was dizzy. I was so dizzy I was hitting the walls as I walked by them. And a friend of mine that a lot of you know, Gay Garner, called, and the minute I answered the telephone, she knew something was wrong. She said, "What's the matter?" I said, "I don't know, but I'm so dizzy I can't walk." She said, "I'll be there as quick as I can get there." And she came, and she took me to one of those medic clinics. And they checked me and said, "Get her to the hospital." So she got, my oldest son was living in Atlanta at that time, and she got a hold of Tom, And they met us at the hospital. And they said I had congestive heart failure. But it wasn't bad enough for me to stay in the hospital. So Tom and Diane and his wife took me home with them. And the next morning, Tom came in and sat down on the side of the bed. And he said, "Now, Mom, you're going to have to quit your job." And I started crying. And he said, "What in the heck are you crying about?" And I said, "I cannot live on my income without working." And he looked at me and said, "Now, let me tell you something." I said, "And I don't want to be a burden on you boys." He said, "We both know how hard you've worked. Neither one of us would have the education we've got if it weren't for you. Consequently, we wouldn't have the jobs we've got." Now, don't deny us the privilege of doing something for you. And then he really topped it off. He said, "You're always saying the serenity prayer. Now, let's see if you really believe it." I threw up my hands and said, "Okay." And since that day, those two boys have sent me a check every month. And they keep raising it as the cost of living goes up. I've got some income, but it's not enough for me to live on. But they have made it possible for me to have a lovely apartment, two bedrooms and two bathrooms, which I need like a hole in my head. But I've got them because they said, "You're going to have guests, and you've got to have a place for them." My oldest son's wife is, well, she's not a daughter-in-law, she's a daughter. And I love her dearly. And they are very, very happy. They're living in Massachusetts now. And I go up every year and stay for a while. And I start laughing when I get off the plane. And I'm still laughing when I get back on the plane to come home. Because they both have a wonderful sense of humor. And they keep you laughing. They're so laid back. Nothing's a big deal. I think Tom got a little AA in his life. Living around Watt and I. Because nothing's a big deal with him. Life is to be lived and enjoyed. And that's the way he feels. He had a whole house full of kids. God. Five of them. Four boys and one girl. Because they're all grown now. And they gather at my house every once in a while and overwhelm me. The youngest boy married, and it didn't work out. But they had a little boy. And he's one of the sweetest young men I know. And then Evan married again, and married a lovely girl. I'd give anything if Watt Lindsay could come back in spirit and see what's going on in their lives. I can just see his face. This boy is one of those gung-ho pushers. He said when he was growing up, "By the time I'm 50, I'm going to be a millionaire, and I'll be darned if I don't think he's going to make it." But they have a little girl. If some of you here have heard me talk in conversation, they know she's the light of my life. She's the only grandchild I've got that's little now. And I took care of her for a little while after her mother went back to work. And there was an awful lot of bonding went on. And everybody that sees her says, there's Lucille. They say she looks like me. I can't see it, but everybody says she looks like me. But I just adore that child. Nancy and Evan talk to her like she's grown, and she's smart enough to absorb it. And it's amazing the things she comes out with. She's in private school, and they put them where they think they can do the best work. She's officially finishing up second grade. And I was talking to her on the phone. They've had her in third grade math now for about 6 months. I was talking to her on the phone one night, and I said, Julia, how's school? And I heard this great big sigh. And she said, Grandma, it's getting progressively more challenging. I almost dropped the telephone. And after I hung up, I sat there all by myself and laughed like an idiot. It tickled me to death. But she's a doll, and I love her dearly. The boy that Evan had is now attending Vanderbilt. He's studying pre-med. I told him he'd never make it in time to look after me. He had to double up and hurry up if he was going to look after me. But he's one of the sweetest boys you ever saw. Kind and loving. And for that, I'm very grateful. So you see what can happen to you. A poor, sick drunk like me. Coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have been showered with more blessings than I know what to do with. They just keep coming. They just keep coming. And if I die today, nobody in this world ever had a fuller life, more love, and more happiness than I've had. And I owe every bit of it to Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's no way on God's green earth that I can ever repay my debt. And I owe you and all the millions of people like you for my life. Thank you.